Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. Today's episode features an interview I did with Scylla Whatcott. She is a classical homeopath, PhD trained, and has every credential possible, basically, on homeopathy. She's the producer of the Real Immunity documentary, and we discuss homeoprophylaxis and our relationship to microbes. This is a very important topic. I then interviewed Jeremy Hammond. He's the author of the book he wrote about me, The War on Informed Consent. He's also an independent journalist who covers everything controversial that has to do with our government and freedom. He's covering the FDA, the CDC, misinformation, and public health and official disinformation, flipping the script on what's really going on here with the information wars that are out there. And he really discusses COVID vaccines and what's the truth behind the data. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I wanted to discuss today powerlessness, letting go, unlearning. Here's the thing, so many of us, I know myself, I long for what I call freedom. Freedom from addiction, freedom from ego. Man, have I been into ego in my past. And freedom from the need to be right. It just comes from a different level of consciousness. Here's the thing, and you've heard this certainly if you've been involved with any sort of spiritual traditions, religious growth. We have to suffer to get well. We have to surrender to win. We have to die to live, and we've got to give it away to keep it. It just doesn't make sense, and yet it does when you experience it. Opening to love, to joy, to laughter. It's really about unlearning and letting go. I've lived that this past 2-3 years. I think as a society, we are being called to live that. Let go and let love. Welcome, Scylla Whatcott. What a pleasure it is to have you on Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here. Thanks.
You and I met, I believe it was when you were putting on a conference here in Oregon that I attended. And that was my proper introduction to homeopathy. You are probably one of the world experts in this field. You are a classical homeopath. You even have a PhD in homeopathy. I didn't even know such a thing existed.
It's obscure.
Yes, you're an instructor at Normandale Community College for the past 8 years. You're the author of There Is a Choice and co-authored The Solution, Homeoprophylaxis. You're the producer and director of the Real Immunity documentary. You've published numerous articles. You're the executive director of Real Immunity, and people can find you at realimmunity.org. This is an organization I know you're active training medical license providers on how to do homeoprophylaxis, which I know we're going to talk about. I know you've lectured around the world and you've organized numerous international conferences. So what a privilege it is to have you on the show.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here. And yeah, I interviewed you for the Real Immunity series. So you are featured in the very first episode, which is available on my site free of charge, that first 20 minutes of the first episode. And the rest of it's available on Gaia.com.
So wonderful. Yeah, I think where we intersect is, you know, you've been doing this a lot longer than I have as far as focusing on true wellness, health, building it from the beginning, as opposed to the pharmaceutical model that I was trained in. So I had to sort of wake up to the fact that there was a different way, and I would say a better way, clearly. Let's introduce our audience. I mean, some people just have a knee-jerk reaction to homeopathy. If you're trained, you know, as I was, MD kind of training, it's just most of my peers just reject it outright. They have no understanding of what's going on. It's sort of been given such a bad name going way back to, you can probably give the history, but homeopathy in Europe, I know, is a first
first line of health for many people before they would ever dream of going to a traditional classic MD, for example. But give us a little introduction to what homeopathy is, and then we'll get into homeoprophylaxis, which is, I'm very interested in hearing more about.
Sure. So homeopathy has been maligned for a number of years, ever since the Flexner report in the early 1900s. Most of the hospitals taught homeopathy. They were homeopathic hospitals, basically. So it was very well utilized, and a lot of natural methods were utilized. But the Flexner report came in and really shifted the face of homeopathy. The AMA was formed. They literally disallowed any homeopaths or association with homeopaths. So married couples that were practicing homeopathy and any other kind of medicine, there was a rift. There was it was a very difficult time. And the purpose was to promote pharmaceuticals, because the pharmaceutical boards came in, they sat on all the medical school boards and dictated treatment. So treatment really got shifted to pharmaceutical application at that point. And,
And the pharmaceutical industry benefited, I would say, from not only massive money and influence that was brought on by industry, Rockefeller, et cetera. But I mean, they had some real positive things to bring to the world. I mean, you think about antibiotics. I mean, they have a place. At times, certain infections just would kill you if you didn't have access to antibiotics. So they were able to ride on the coattails of those sorts of successes and then just sort of
And the ease of treating many people with one drug, because homeopathy is very individualized. And you have to take a case. You know, five people could have the same diagnosis and get five different remedies. So it's arduous.
It's really the art of medicine.
Yeah, it's more of an art. And it's over 200 years ago, Hahnemann in Germany, Dr. Hahnemann, he was a linguist, he was a chemist, he was a physician, and he was translating medical texts from different languages. And he looked at like treating like. So basically, Hippocrates himself would see a child fall down with seizures, grab a plant called hyoscyamus or henbane, give that plant which causes seizures, and it would either cure the child or kill the child because it was too strong. And Hahnemann decided, let's dilute it and let's make it, you know, not strong, but still have the frequency, the energy, the information in that plant. So he began experimenting on himself mostly. And then he began observing like cases of mercury poisoning, arsenic poisoning, and seeing that if he took those very toxic substances and diluted them and gave them in very small amounts, they could cure people from those conditions. So, you know, it was really the most modern medicine of the day and is still utilized in many countries and endorsed. Like in India, they train doctors and they work for the government. So it's very well utilized in Cuba, in South America, in India, and respected. So homeoprophylaxis is a subset of homeopathy. And by that, I mean that Hahnemann was treating children in Germany for scarlet fever. And what he found in one home, he was treating them with belladonna. And he found in the homeopathic remedy, belladonna. And he found in one home, one child was receiving belladonna for a chronic condition, and she never contracted scarlet fever, even though other members of the family did. And he started to reason that it could prevent as well as treat a disease. So he started utilizing it as a preventative, and it ultimately became a requirement in the Prussian government to give belladonna during the outbreaks, during the epidemics. So it was used as a prophylactic during the epidemics.
Interesting. And that was at very low homeopathic doses, right?
Correct, because it has, you know, it can be, it's poisonous at high doses.
Right,
you don't.
Right. I remember in medical school, our literature was all putting down homeopathy because of the dangers of belladonna. And they were quoting use of belladonna and not at homeopathic doses, right? So yeah, that confusion and not being aware of how important that whole dosing is. I think for our viewers who aren't familiar with homeopathy, is it safe to say that the dilutions are to such an extent that we're dealing with sometimes energy, not even molecules, and therefore the safety of it is absolute. I mean, you just cannot poison yourself homeopathically.
The safety is absolute. And the way it's diluted in homeopathic pharmacies, so this is overseen, this is regulated, and it's diluted. You take a source solution and you add one part of that to 99 parts of a solution, and you succuss it or shake it, and you have a 1C solution. C is Roman numeral for 100. So it's 100 drops or parts in there. You take one part of that, put it into 99 parts of a solution, and you have a 2C solution. You continue to do that serially. When you get to 12C, there are no molecules apparent in that dilution. So anything over 12C has none of the original substance in it. It's completely safe. And one of the founders of the FDA was a homeopath. So there are homeopathic remedies on the pharmacopoeia, the FDA homeopathic pharmacopoeia.
Interesting. I had not realized that the FDA had been involved with homeopathy. You would think they were part of the problem of making sure nobody had access to it.
Well, that's many years ago. You know, most of the doctors practiced homeopathy. So,
yeah. So in my world, I'm a pediatrician. Most people know that. And the big thing that I stumbled on, as you know, the story was the fact that vaccinated kids seem to be not doing as well as unvaccinated kids. And I ultimately published that study in November of 2019, or sorry, 2020. So vaccines are not homeopathy. You have real high doses of adjuvants, for example, aluminum, that we know has no biological benefit in the body. And so it's a toxic substance put in to irritate the tissue so you get an adequate immune response. And while some vaccines, the live virus vaccines, for example, I mean, we know they're fairly effective. We've wiped out the natural chickenpox. We've got other problems because of that from the varicella vaccine, and same with measles and rubella. Those vaccines being live virus attenuated were fairly effective, but they come with a lot of collateral damage, as we now are becoming aware of. They're, because of the amazing safety of homeopathy, I wonder if you might speak to this issue of homeoprophylaxis and maybe just explain what that is and how, in a way, it's a safe, completely safe alternative to mainstream vaccines.
Sure. So homeoprophylaxis is the use of these highly dilute substances made from animal, mineral, vegetable sources, or from nosodes. Nosodes are exudate from diseases, so saliva or pus, or you know, some kind of something from someone with the disease would be called a nosode. So that's what we use. They are diluted and succussed, so there's no molecules. It's basically information that we're transmitting, and that is given prior to exposure to a disease. And in doing so, the person becomes familiarized. Their energy system, their vital force, because homeopathy is vitalistic, right? We work with the whole person and the vitality. The vital force recognizes the frequency of that particular virus or bacteria. So if met in public, an appropriate immune response can be raised. So what this does is, we're not fighting the disease anymore. We're associating with the disease in a way that you become so familiar that the danger is eliminated from the disease. So that's the short explanation. It's been used for 200 years very successfully. And I'm happy to share different studies or events that occurred using homeoprophylaxis as well.
Are those studies by any chance available at your website?
They are. If you go to realimmunity.org, O-R-G, go to the products and click on the Knowledge Vault. It's free, but you have to make an account to get in there. And in the Knowledge Vault, there's a chapter for homeoprophylaxis, and the studies are there.
Fantastic.
So they can see, yeah, meningitis, Japanese encephalitis, dengue fever, leptospirosis, a number of tropical diseases, and children's infectious contagious diseases as well. A 15-year study out of Australia by Dr. Golden.
Wow. When we have things like novel viruses or rare infections that are, for whatever reason, becoming more prevalent or even epidemic. So we've all gone through COVID-19 this past couple years. It just occurred to me, has anybody made a homeoprophylaxis product for COVID?
Absolutely. So Cuba is one of the forerunners in making different products and utilizing them with their population. So I consulted with Dr. Isaac Golden, who's in Australia, but he goes to Cuba and consults with them all the time. And we came up with a combination. Cuba tweaked it and uses it in drops. And they said it was for multiple viruses. They, you know, they were focusing on that C named virus, but it did cover multiple viruses. Mine was a little bit different. I used it for a year and I took about 500 people, did a casual survey just saying, did you get sick? You know, did you take it? Did you get sick? If so, how long were you sick? What were your symptoms? And what I found is that I believe it was 4 people got sick out of my 500 and their symptoms lasted less than 6 days. So
wow.
They did very well. And basically,
that's a little less than 1%.
Yeah. Yeah. It works. I've been doing it for 15, 20 years and I watch, you know, during flu season, my people that take a form of influenzinum that I provide compared to those who are getting flu shots, the difference is graphic. You know, it's very distinct.
Yeah. So, you know, way back to, was it Hippocrates who said, let food be thy medicine? You know, homeopathy is almost like even better than that. I mean, you're tapping into vital energy, which is something I don't completely understand, but I believe it. I mean, folks, if you don't understand that everything is energy, then just start at least opening your possibilities to the fact that when things aren't going so well, as we've seen happen this past couple of years, it's time to start really opening our minds to perhaps there is another way or even a better way.
Right. A choice. Einstein said it's not philosophy, it's physics. Everything's energy. Everything.
Yeah.
And we're beginning to see that. And, you know, MRIs, x-rays, these things are based on energy. And if you took someone from 200 years ago and said, we're going to stand you against a screen and see your bones, they would have thought you were crazy.
Yeah. So it seems like perhaps this is a real tool for not only the current epidemic, as it will be called, but future possible epidemics.
Absolutely. And there's some very distinct reasons why homeoprophylaxis, HP, is so valuable in epidemics. One, it can be created very rapidly. It doesn't take a lot of hoops to jump through to make it. Two, it doesn't require cold chain. So you can distribute it all over the world very quickly and easily without having to be refrigerated. Three, it's because it's not an injection, it's taken by mouth, non-medical professionals can administer it. During natural disasters, we had Homeopaths Without Borders go to foreign countries and teach people how to administer it. So, you know, easily administrable. It it's not gender specific or age specific or even species specific. So you can put it in the water trough of animals. You can give it to children, adults, same dose, which is great. And it also addresses all mutations. So unlike vaccines that have to be remade, redistributed, HP is looking at the symptom picture. So even if there's a mutation, and we know all microbes mutate, right? I mean, that's right. Inevitable. So it adapts to those mutations. So I'm using the same HP for diseases like pertussis or measles or meningitis that's been used for 100 years because the original, what's the word I'm looking for? The original source of all microbes is thousands of years old. They just keep mutating. And as they interact with human beings, they lend to our evolution, right? So we've seen that there are certain, is it viruses that are necessary for the placenta to form? Remember reading this? Our evolution's based on microbes, right? Our bodies are 90% microbes, 80% microbes.
Yeah, most people don't appreciate that. We're more microbe than we are human.
Right. So, you know, conducting a war against them, is that really what we want to do?
It makes no sense.
None whatsoever. It's an infantile approach. We'll destroy ourselves. We'll destroy our planet. We need to work with them.
Yeah.
And that's what HP does.
Wow. So I'm reading about, I'm sure you've seen this too, the next new big fear microbe, monkeypox. This supposedly is a relative of smallpox. What is the HP response to this, if there is one?
We certainly have one. And it would be, because it's in the same species as smallpox, it would be the same as smallpox. But, you know, people have contacted me and I'm very reluctant to generate the fear. You know, I'm not selling a widget. That's not my goal. My goal is to educate and support people who are broadening their thinking, who are looking for where we need to go as a population. So I don't want to promote, oh, I have something for monkeypox, because I don't think it's a threat.
What would be your recommendations for the typical listener who, regardless of where they are on the spectrum of fear, let's just say they want to be proactive, they want to be prepared. What do you want people to know?
So there, you know, on the Real Immunity site, there's a lot of information. And I have a formulation for seasonal flu that covers the current virus that's going around as well, that people have been happy with. With children, there's a program with 8 diseases. And the interesting thing, Paul, is that, you know, your study is monumental, where you showed that the unvaxxed had more robust immunity. So when Isaac Golden did his study with about 3,000 children in Australia, it was over 15 years, and he anticipated that the unvaxxed children would have more robust immunity than the HP children. So he had these two groups and the vaccinated children. And the HP children actually had more robust immunity than the unvaccinated children. And his conjecture was that they were getting all these diseases. So the frequency of these diseases were passing through their systems without any risk, without any symptoms, you know, and that's what Mother Nature intended, for us to associate with these different microbes. And these kids were getting these microbes. And so that program is available on my site. And what I like to do, it's really teaching and supporting. So it comes with a kit, it comes with a video teaching people the dosing schedule, it comes with a parent booklet where they keep records, also an appointment with me to individualize the program and to answer any questions, and most importantly, support for at least 3 years, the duration of the program. So my main goal is to educate and support parents. I want to share that I was conventional. I vaccinated my children. I have four. They're adopted from China, Russia, Taiwan. I have one biological that I gave birth to. But, you know, when my daughter from China went into aseptic meningitis immediately after receiving her shots, that was my moment to research. And that was 25 years ago. I started researching and I learned it's a side effect of one of them. So, you know, it was my personal experience that brought me to this place, and hearing other parents and what they have endured and seen, as you have in your practice. So I like to offer parents a free consult as well, 15 minutes. If they go to the site, there I have two other practitioners. So depending on who they sign up under, you know, they can meet with one of us for 15 minutes to chat, get to know us, ask questions. We're happy to do that. And yeah, parents have been super happy with having an option.
Wow, fantastic. Well, you're providing a really important service. Folks, go to realimmunity.org. So thank you so much for being on Against the Wind, and God bless you.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Welcome, Jeremy Hammond, back to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. It is such an honor and privilege to have you on the show.
It's my honor to be speaking with you again.
Thank you. You are one of those rare, really rare these days, independent journalists. We got to know each other quite well when you called me up, and I was under my challenge with the medical board in Oregon, and you wanted to interview me. And out of that came an entire book, The War on Informed Consent, The Persecution of Dr. Paul Thomas, there it is, by the Oregon Medical Board. Which was a masterpiece. My goodness, it has been the most important resource for my attorneys. So thank you for doing all that hard work. I know you've written lots of other books. The Obstacle to Peace is another important one. But I mean, you're just one of those guys that if there's something going on that the world needs to know about, I mean, you're all about exposing dangerous state propaganda.
Yeah, that's how I advertise my work, is I expose dangerous state propaganda serving to manufacture consent for criminal government policies. Yeah. Borrowing the phrase manufacturing consent from Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, who wrote the book Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy from the Mass Media, they in turn were borrowing it from Walter Lippmann and others. But that really is, you know, the overarching goal of everything that I do, by happenstance, I guess, wasn't what I set out to start doing. It just, that's the nature of the work that I do is, you know, like, for example, I started out speaking out against the Iraq war and exposing the lies the government was telling the people about weapons of mass destruction and all that. Over the years, you just evolved into a focus on vaccines since the birth of my son. And now that's really all I have time for. There's so much deception and lies surrounding the vaccine program that I really, there's, it's just such a huge, huge problem that really needs addressing. And so when I actually did a deep dive into the literature for my own purposes, for our person to be able to make our own personal choices with the birth of our son, I was expecting to find a disparity. But, you know, what I found, the gap is just so incredibly huge between what they say the science says and what we actually know from scientific studies and the literature. And so it just, once I had acquired that knowledge, I just made a decision, like, I can't keep this knowledge to myself. I have to start writing about this, and eventually shifted my focus entirely from like foreign policy and economics, to public health.
So let's dive into that a little bit. You've done a, analysis of the FDA's fraudulent risk benefit analysis that they used to approve Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use in infants and toddlers. This just happened this past month where, I mean, they just rammed it through every step of the way. What did your research find?
They made the decision to authorize the Pfizer vaccine for emergency use in children under five, down to infants as young as 6 months, on the basis of no data showing efficacy against symptomatic infection. Instead, they relied on what they call an immunobridging analysis, which is where they measure antibodies in younger children who've received the first two doses of the vaccine. The original protocol of the trial was for two doses with a vaccine. That didn't get them to the level of antibodies that they wanted to achieve, so they added a third dose. And then comparing the level of antibodies in the younger children with antibodies induced in older children for whom, you know, the vaccine had already been authorized. And so this was the basis of their fraud, because the FDA knows that just because, you know, there's a certain level of antibodies in the blood, it does not mean that you have immunity. So antibodies do not equal immunity. And yet for the purposes of this authorization, they treated an antibody titer reaching a certain level as equivalent of proof of immunity, which is scientifically fraudulent, and the FDA knows it. In fact, the FDA has warned the public against using positive antibody tests as a basis to judge whether you have immunity or not, which is disingenuous when it comes to natural immunity, because with natural immunity, evidence of prior infection is evidence of immunity, because we know from the scientific literature that almost everyone who recovers from infection comes away with strong natural immunity.
True. And the immune system is so much more than just antibodies. And so this is sort of the little dirty secret of the vaccine industry, is they just focus on the ability to have the body make antibodies, and therefore they've done their job. And they never look at all health outcomes, or even whether that specific infection is reduced by their vaccine.
Right. And in fact, for the they separated the younger children into two age groups. Actually, they did 6 months to 23 months and then 2 to 4 years. And among the 2 to 4 year olds, there was actually a higher rate of severe adverse events and a higher rate of reinfections among the vaccinated group. So this is the data that the FDA used to push to ram through this authorization. I mean, it's miserably poor data. And the whole document is just riddled with scientific fraud, like outright fraud, You know, making claims that are false, citing studies saying that they say one thing and they don't say that. As example, claiming that one study showed a 16-fold increased relative risk of myocarditis for COVID-19 patients, as opposed to patients who didn't have COVID-19. In fact, the source that they cited for that, you know, I go and check the sources. This is what I do. It was actually, and the odds ratio was an 8-fold increase, not 16-fold. So they doubled the relative risk that was reported. And then they deliberately withheld the absolute risk reported by that paper, which was 0.1%. And in fact, the authors of that paper emphasized that, you know, even though there's this increased relative risk that seems sizable, when you put that into perspective of the actual risk of this outcome is still very low. And policymakers need to stress that and report the absolute risk as well as the relative risk. Yeah. And yet, what did the FDA do? They withheld the absolute risk, and they didn't report that in the paper or in the document. So there's examples like this where they, you know, they're cherry picking information. Another example is they cited over 7%. They cited a survey in the UK as indicating that, you know, over 7% of children who have test positive for SARS-CoV-2 have symptoms of long COVID, so persistent symptoms. In fact, the authors of that paper likewise, you know, pointed out that their study was not methodologically robust to be able to draw any conclusions from that finding. And they specifically said that, you know, you can't use this as a basis to estimate the prevalence of long COVID among children. They specifically warned against inferring that this was the actual prevalence of long COVID, because they couldn't It was just a survey of self-reported symptoms. And other studies, so they're citing the seven, you know, over 7%, you know, which is pretty frightening. Well, you know, a 7 out of 100 kids develop long COVID. But, you know, looking at studies that have actually estimated the prevalence, it appears to be much, much lower. In fact, at this point, it's quite low, especially since Omicron. And interestingly, you know, what's happened is a lot of the earlier studies didn't have control groups. A lot of the ones reporting very high prevalence of long COVID didn't have control groups. And so the studies that actually use control groups have found like almost no significant differences in symptoms between people who have evidence of prior infection and people who don't. And in fact, one study even showed that just the belief of having been infected with COVID, even if there was no evidence that the individual actually had an infection, just the belief that they had COVID-19 was associated with increased reporting of long-term symptoms. Yeah. And another systematic review found that studies that the higher the quality of the study, the lower the estimated prevalence of long COVID. And specifically looking when they had just looked at the studies with that actually had control groups, I think the only symptom that they found that there was a significant difference with was loss of smell and taste.
Yeah, that's the one new thing from COVID infections, at least the early strains. I have a control group. My practice, I'm not allowed to do research because of my board stipulations for keeping my license, but I can anecdotally say that out of over probably about 6,000 active patients during the entire COVID era, I don't think I have a single patient with long COVID.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it's greatly over reported or however, I don't know what they're doing. You had listed.
Well, it is confounded. I forgot to mention because it's confounded by so many other factors, including the detrimental health effects of the lockdowns and all the fear mongering. Right. And so this is something that the studies that actually control for that, those detrimental effects. And the authors of these studies have pointed that out, like, you know, like there's so much like trauma on the population from the government's responses to COVID-19, that is a detrimental effect on people's health that you have to control for.
Yeah. So, you know, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is this captured agency. That's just my subjective feeling, but I think there's a lot of evidence for the fact that they really work for pharma. And you talk about five horrifying facts about the FDA vaccine approval process. Yeah. What are those?
Oh gosh, it's been a while since I reviewed my own document there. But you know, for one, you know, and I wrote that before the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, at a time when, you know, I used to have this kind of perception that the FDA like did its own like studies, that there was like this independent review of pharmaceutical products. Right. And that's not true. The FDA doesn't do its own studies. So that's one thing, is that they rely on the pharmaceutical industry's own studies, which of course they can kind of submit the data that they like and to just withhold the data that they don't like. And so that's kind of this bias in the vaccine approval process. So, you know, that's another thing, is that, you know, a lot of times they don't use placebos, you know, in clinical trials. They use active comparators. So, for example, an injection of aluminum rather than a saline placebo. And then so that conceals the true background rate of adverse events, so that it enables them to report that, you know, the rate of adverse events between the vaccine group and the supposed placebo control, you know, the placebo group, that then it's not actually a placebo, are similar. And so they can say, oh, look, it's safe. So there's lots of, you know, really foul play at work in this. Another aspect, you know, thing I wrote about in that paper that I have, that, you know, you can sign up for my newsletter and get that for free, download it, is not so much related to the approval process, but just to the process of getting these vaccines to market, is the fact that the vaccine manufacturers have legal immunity against vaccine injury lawsuits since the 1986 law was enacted, granting them broad legal immunity. So if the vaccine is recommended by the CDC for use in children, they get almost blanket liability protection. The only two conditions under which they could be sued would be fraud. So, for example, making claims in their product inserts, which are, they have to legally disclose, you know, the risks of the vaccine, the known risks in those documents. So if they could, you know, if they were to just come out and make claims in there that, that were false, or they didn't disclose things that they knew, you know, that they could be sued for that. Or if they make some kind of manufacturing error and they, you know, they put the wrong ingredient in or something like that. So very narrow, limited liability there. But generally, they just have protection against immunity. And this is relevant for today because, you know, one of the reasons that they have been pushing so hard, in my opinion, for getting these vaccines into the arms of children is that if they can add the COVID-19 vaccines to the routine childhood schedule, then they will have, the manufacturers will have legal immunity.
Yeah, they won't need that emergency use authorization forever.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So another interesting aspect I think you've looked into is the fact that the CDC has been claiming that natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2 is inferior to that induced by COVID-19 vaccines. But I mean, a lot of us who are looking into this know that the opposite to be true.
Yeah, when the vaccines were first authorized in December 2020, the CDC came out saying that scientists don't know the duration of natural immunity, but indications were that it was short-lived. That was false at the time. Studies had already shown that infection induces immunologic memory, with evidence indicating that it induced production of what are called long-term bone marrow plasma cells, which are an immunological marker of long-term immunity, a known marker. And then that finding was later in May 2021, that was confirmed that yes, natural infection does induce this long-term immunologic memory, which we can anticipate will probably last throughout most people's lifetimes. Now, that doesn't mean they won't lose a certain level of antibodies. Antibodies do wane over time. However, as we've already discussed, antibodies do not equal immunity, and there's a lot more going on with the immune system than just antibodies. And in fact, with SARS-CoV-2, it appears that cellular immunity plays the more important role, particularly in protecting against severe disease. And in fact, again, going back to the point of the FDA's scientific fraud, where they're using this immunobridging analysis, where they're measuring antibodies in children's blood, actually, there's been a consistent finding since the start of the pandemic that a high level of antibodies is associated with severe COVID-19, so severe disease and death, whereas people who have mild symptoms or no disease at all with infection tended to generate a lower level of antibodies. So this idea that you have to have a high level of antibodies to have protection is actually falsified. We know that that's not true.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, children have a much more robust innate immune system, that cellular immunity you were speaking to, which is why children are almost universally unaffected by SARS-CoV-2. I mean, they just do well. What is it, 99.997% survival rate? I mean, it's just like, it's no big deal. There is no emergency, right? So you have to...
There's no emergency. They authorized it for, quote, unquote, emergency use in children. What's the emergency?
Yeah, there is no emergency. And yet they got it through and got it approved. Yeah. Thankfully, very few parents are taking their young kids in. I think people are starting to wake up.
Yeah, you know, that's half glass full, optimistic point of view that, you know, with the FDA having done this, it's just such transparent. That's the thing about it. You know, it's not, when I say that their authorization was based on scientific fraud, it's not even hidden. I mean, any journalist worth the title could read that document and see just transparently that what the FDA was doing was completely unscientific. You know, and I only just touched on the fraud. I mean, getting deeper into their immunobridging analysis, for example, they didn't even measure antibodies against the circulating variants. Any of the against Omicron or any of its subvariants, they measured the antibodies against the original Wuhan strain of the virus, which is now extinct outside of laboratories. Even though they know, I mean, of course, this FDA knows, everyone there knows that these vaccines, which were designed to induce an immune response to the spike protein of the original Wuhan strain, do not induce the same level of neutralizing antibodies against Omicron. There is far, the neutralizing titers are far lower against Omicron. And studies have confirmed that something called original antigenic sin is a real serious problem with COVID-19 vaccines, whereby the training of the immune system to generate that immune response to that extinct spike protein, the spike protein of that extinct variant, results in this fixation of the immune system so that it fails to adapt. So if, you know, once you're vaccinated and then you're infected with Omicron, the antibodies, you know, there is a very transient protection from that, but it's not because the antibodies that are generated are specific to Omicron. They're still specific to the original Wuhan strain. They just happen to be able to still cross-react with the spike protein of Omicron, because there are similarities still, of course, you know, despite the many mutations that have occurred in the spike protein of Omicron. And so it's just a cross-reactive immune response, whereas with natural immunity, they've shown that the immune response is adaptive and able to generate antibodies that in time become more specific to Omicron. And so natural immunity really must be understood as an opportunity cost of vaccination. And that is a factor that, as ever, public health officials and policymakers just fail to take that into consideration. They absolutely fail to consider natural immunity as an opportunity cost of vaccination. And that's a huge logical fallacy underlying all of their decision making for the entire vaccine program. We're not just talking COVID-19 vaccines here.
No, it's so true. Natural immunity provides a much more broad and robust level of protection, both cellular and antibody, and it's recognizing entire sequences or much larger sequences when you speak of COVID, as opposed to the narrow little sequence that was provided for the vaccine.
Right, which ties back into that what we're talking about the CDC lying about natural immunity. You know, I mentioned back in when the vaccines were first authorized, how the CDC put out this deceptive statement, failing to disclose to people that actually studies had shown that natural immunity was likely to be quite long lasting. And then come August of 2021, the CDC actually started explicitly claiming that the vaccines induced superior protection than natural immunity, which, of course, you know, I wrote about at the time as being demonstrably false. I mean, study after study after study had shown just the opposite. But the CDC came out with that claim some months later. I think it was January this year. CDC researchers published a study in the CDC's journal, the MMWR, acknowledging that, you know, falsifying the CDC's claim in August, which of course was at a time during Delta predominance, and their own data showed that actually natural immunity was considerably more protective than being fully vaccinated against Delta, including against hospitalization. You know, the CDC's own data falsified its earlier claim that natural immunity was inferior. We know this to be false.
Sure, hard to take the CDC seriously anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately, again, people are waking up. You know, I mean, the brazenness with which they are lying to people, and like the brazenness with which the FDA is willing to conduct scientific fraud to push through an authorization. I mean, it's just so transparent now. Like, even the most ardent, hardcore public policy advocates, you know, like Paul Offit, like distancing himself from the FDA's decision. He was one of two dissenting members of the FDA's advisory committee who didn't vote, for example, to add an Omicron component to booster shots for a fall booster campaign. The reason being because there was no data indicating that that would be beneficial.
Yeah.
And Paul Offit, he wrote an article, I think it was in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, talking about original antigenic, you know, acknowledging original antigenic sin as a potential problem with these vaccines. And in talking about how, you know, they've already done research in development, trying to develop vaccines for Omicron. And why don't we have one yet? Well, because when they've tried to do it, they ran into this problem of original antigenic sin with the boosters. Yeah, they increase antibody titers a bit, but they're antibodies to the original Wuhan strain still. Yeah. And so they're not specific to Omicron because of original antigenic sin. And so this has been the major obstacle in development of a variant-specific vaccine. Paul Offit is aware of this. And so for him to kind of like publicly distance himself from the FDA's decision-making is really kind of a remarkable turn of events, I think, because of course, you know, everyone in the health freedom movement, most of us are familiar with Paul Offit is, you know, just like such a staunch, hardcore pro-vaccine policy advocate.
Just for fun, Z, because I have brought this topic up in previous shows, ivermectin. So why or what's going on with the official information being disseminated about ivermectin? Just from the beginning, it seems like they did everything possible to make sure nobody got their hands on this amazing product.
Well, this again ties into the FDA's approval and authorization process, because to receive emergency use authorization for these vaccines to get the EUA, status from the FDA, there has to be, according to FDA regulations, there has to be no other approved treatments for COVID-19. And so I think that to me is the most obvious explanation for why the government was engaged in such a campaign of disinformation related to ivermectin, which of course the media, the mainstream media, as usual, played right along with, you know, doing public policy advocacy rather than, you know, journalism. And an example, I hadn't written much about ivermectin just because I've been so focused on the vaccines and fighting the lockdowns and things like that. But I did write one article not too long ago just to debunk mainstream media misinformation about a study that had come out. And all the headlines were claiming study shows that ivermectin doesn't work. But that's not what the study showed at all. In fact, the ivermectin-treated group in that study fared quite better. It's just that they didn't have a large sample population. There wasn't a lot of people in the study. And so the results didn't reach statistical significance. Well, that's you can't interpret a statistically insignificant finding as showing that ivermectin didn't work, because they did fare better. And had there been more people in the study, it very well may have achieved statistical significance. We don't know. They would have to redo the study with a larger group to be able to tell. But to take that finding and report that, oh, this study shows that ivermectin doesn't work, was completely dishonest. And so I wrote an article correcting the record. Incidentally, LinkedIn cited that article of mine as one of the reasons to suspend my LinkedIn account for supposedly spreading, quote unquote, misinformation.
So it feels like our public vaccine policy is more faith-based, not evidence-based. You have an example, I think, that you've talked about or written about. I think it was Deborah Birx.
Well, there's a number. Yeah, Deborah Birx is one who she was put the question was put to her by a congressman of, you know, referring to the earlier claims. I mean, if you think back, the vaccines were sold to the public on the grounds that that was the path out of the pandemic, that they were going to induce herd immunity, and they would induce, you know, two doses would induce durable sterilizing immunity that was going to prevent infection and transmission, and thereby we'd have herd immunity and the pandemic would end. That's how the vaccines were sold to the public. That was the claim that was being made by public health officials, including Birx. And yet, so the question was put to her, you know, were officials lying or were they guessing? Which is kind of the question is wrong, because if it had been guessing, that's still lying. Because if you make a guess about something and you communicate that guess as though that's scientifically, you know, factual information, mm-hmm. that's still lying. But anyhow, aside from the problem with the question, her answer was instructive, because she didn't even attempt to deny the fact that the government officials had misinformed the public. She acknowledged it. And she said that the explanation for that was hope. They were hoping that the vaccines would do what they were claiming the vaccines would do.
So, Jeremy, as we get close to wrapping up here, what is going on with your peers? I get asked the same thing in my field, right? I'm a pediatrician, I'm a doctor, and how come my peers cannot see the facts that are clearly laid out in front of us? You're in journalism. What's going on with journalists today?
I attribute the blindness, the willful blindness, to another term I borrow from Noam Chomsky, the state religion. And the vaccine religion is a subsect of the state religion, you know. And I, you know, I wrote about this before I ever got into the topic of vaccines when I was dealing with foreign policy issues, and I would just describe the state religion whereby, you know, journalists succumb to their own confirmation biases. There's just kind of the, you know, this belief among Americans, regardless of profession, that, you know, America is the greatest country, and the government, you know, sometimes makes mistakes, but only ever has benevolent intentions. And, you know, this like this belief in American exceptionalism, you know, so there's this kind of confirmation bias, I think, that people have. Just the same as in the medical profession, where you know, I discuss this in my book, where you were one of, you know, the rare individual who was willing to question your own practices and ask yourself, is what I'm doing, instead of helping these children, is it might I actually be causing harm? And, you know, taking an honest retrospective, introspective look at your own practices and, you know, doing your own research and really starting to do a deep dive into the literature for yourself to kind of be able to answer that question. You know, most doctors aren't like you, and I'm just so thankful to you that we have you. And you know, I just really, I'm grateful to you for that. But that's, it's similar with journalists. You know, they have this unwillingness to question their own beliefs and to challenge their own beliefs. And so there's a certain level of cognitive dissonance as well as confirmation bias. And so I think that's my primary explanation for what we see in terms of the lack of actual journalism in the mainstream media.
Yeah. So your thoughts for moving forward? We live in this dualistic right versus wrong, black and white, you know, it's, everything's polarizing. And I feel like we're not really moving to the solution if we stay in that dualistic framework. How do we move more towards unity and inclusiveness and get beyond this position that we're in right now?
Well, honesty to begin with, again, kind of segueing from what we were just discussing, just a willingness to question your own beliefs, to really not only just question your beliefs, but actively, you know, educate yourself. And being accepting of other people's perspectives, being willing to consider other people's perspectives, and really being willing to challenge your own beliefs is, it can be a very difficult thing to do. But I think we all, as individuals, need to be willing to do that.
Folks, if you want to have access to this amazing work that Jeremy's doing, just go to jeremyhammond.com.
Jeremyrhammond.com. Yeah.
Well, there's an R in there.
Yeah. My middle initials in there.
Of course, if you want to learn more about what I've been going through with the Oregon Medical Board, his book, The War on Informed Consent, is just a masterpiece. If you order it from your website, jeremyrhammond.com, then you actually are supporting his work in a greater way, but it's available wherever books are sold. And you can also donate. The work you're doing is not paid, right? I mean, you had to walk away from lucrative paying jobs in journalism where you would be limited on what you can report on to become truly independent. And that's what makes you so valuable.
Yeah, I don't receive wage, salary, grants, you know, commission for the work I do. Occasionally do freelance projects, but that's quite rare. Most of everything I publish, nobody pays me for, apart from the fact that it's funded by my community of readers. So it is really vital for me to be able to get, you know, reader support. So yeah, if you go to jeremyrhammond.com, please sign up for my newsletter to be able to stay up to date with my work, especially this big paper I've got coming out quite soon. I just think I wrapped up my conclusion today. I do need to do a couple of rounds of editing, but I hope to publish that in the very near future. So you definitely want to be posted once that's out.
Absolutely. Folks, it's upon all of us to support those who are independent, just like doctorsinscience.com is your link to this show, where we are completely member supported. And we appreciate all of you who support independent work and those of us who are really trying to do our best to sift through the misinformation and get you to the truth. The truth is, after all, singular. It is not this or that. It is just what it is. And the truth does win in the end. Thank you, Jeremy, for being a truth seeker and such an important and powerful voice in our health freedom world.
Thank you. Appreciate this conversation.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsinscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsinscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsinscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.